This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 18th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design every single week on Monocle 24. Coming up today, we sport our Sunday clothes for a full 5 days and look back at London Fashion Week as it draws to a close.
The brilliant thing about London Fashion Week is that the whole city gets involved. You get not even just the traditional big name designers, but retailers get involved, you know, restaurants get involved, you see on shop windows everyone talking about it.
We discover how one institutional design brand is palling up with its customers in order to help pave its way into the future.
We passionately believe that it's the combination of physical spaces, really high quality human beings face to face, and great technology behind the scenes.
And we'll dissect London Design Museum's shortlist for the designs of the year, ranging from floating schools in Nigeria to search and rescue drones in the UK's Lake District.
So we've got everything from kind of iPhone apps to crowdsourced search and rescue mechanisms, and the furniture is still in there, but it's kind of pales in comparison to some of the digital technology that we're seeing this year.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's start the show here in London. London Fashion Week began on Friday, running for a full jam-packed 5 days. The event's resurgence back to the top of the fashion calendar has been well documented, with showstoppers Burberry Prawson, Matthew Williamson and Jonathan Saunders all showing here now. Not to mention a whole troop of younger up-and-comers that have also been stealing the headlines. It's great PR for the city, but is showing in London good for business? To chew this over, and much more besides, I was joined by Anna Santi, Deputy Editor of Drapers.
Well, London had been playing a bit of a catch-up with New York, Paris and Milan in the last few years. It was always seen as the lesser of the four. It was the creative one, which is really a way of saying it wasn't very commercial. It didn't really do very much. But I would say that in the last few years, it's completely changed and it's now one of the key players. It sits on a par with all the other three. All the international press attend, some key buyers come along, and it just has a real presence now, and I think has done for the last couple of seasons. 5 years ago, the momentum started when Sir Stuart Rose, who used to run M&S, was the chairman, and he got a lot of funding behind it, really got it going. And then when he handed over to Harold Tilman, who used to own Jaeger, Harold was very good at getting all the big names to come back. So he got Burberry to come back, he got Matthew Williamson to come back, he got Jonathan Saunders to come back, because they were all showing one of the other four. So he really brought that buzz back. And now Natalie Massenet is the chairwoman. It's her first year now. I think she joined last season. And she's continuing with that momentum. And I'm sure we'll want to put her own mark on it as well. It's really part of the International Fashion Week calendar now, without a doubt.
We actually spoke about this in our Look Forward shows over Christmas. Have you noticed what Natalie Massenet's done? Has anything changed with her position there yet?
I think it's still early days. As you said, we talked about it at the end of last year, and she hadn't really done anything in her first season. So we're all looking to see what the effect of this season will be. But she is still keeping that relatively low profile. So we have to keep looking to see what she's going to do. I mean, if you look at this season, there have been more brands joining the roster as well. Joseph has come back to show at London Fashion Week. And Whistles, high street retailer, is showing, premium high street. Even M&S, they actually started last season. So she's still carrying that on. I can't quite predict what her legacy is going to be yet. I still haven't worked that one out yet.
Are orders being written here? Is money being made here yet?
According to the British Fashion Council, who owns London Fashion Week, yes, it is being made. Some £100 million worth of orders are being written. Personally, I think the way that businesses, like big brands, smaller brands, medium brands, should look at London Fashion Week in terms of how to make it a success is to see it as a really good marketing opportunity. I'm sure there is some transactions being made, but the brilliant thing about London Fashion Week is that the whole city gets involved. There's a real buzz around it. You get not even just the traditional big name designers, but retailers get involved. You know, restaurants get involved. You see on shop windows, everyone talking about it. So I think from a marketing point of view, it's really important. I remember speaking to Jonathan Saunders, and he calls London Fashion Week his marketing budget.
Wow.
But funnily enough, his buyers don't actually spend most of their budget on the collection that we see walking down the catwalk. They spend about sort of 70% of their budget on pre-collections. And these are collections that are shown before the main catwalk collection, which you don't see on a catwalk. And they're much more commercial collections. They tend to be quite category-led. So you'll see a collection of dresses, of trousers. It doesn't have all that theatre. Those are the pieces that actually sell. So you sort of think, why spend all this money on this, you know, big collection that you send down the catwalk that you don't make money from? But his argument is, well, if you don't do that, if you don't create theatre, then it's just categories on a rack. And that's true. So I think that's the way to get value out of London Fashion Week, one of the main ways anyway, to see it as a way of really promoting yourself and just raising awareness of what's going on in London and then internationally as well when it comes to press.
I remember about sort of 10 years ago, people walking down the catwalk sort of dressed in toilet roll and like toasters on their head and stuff. It always felt quite juvenile, but I guess that came from the fact that, you know, so many of the amazing fashion design schools in London.
Yeah.
Do you think it's lost that edge now?
I don't think so just yet, but I can see why you're asking that. And I remember a couple of seasons ago feeling that way actually and thinking, oh gosh, it's all a bit proper now. You don't get that shock, but you'll still get Miedem Kirchhoff making you look and feel excited. I think it's more subtle. So I'm always a huge fan of Christopher Kane, and what he does every season I find really incredible, how he manages to surprise you. Not in terms of doing a really theatrical show necessarily, but through the clothing. I think that there are still a lot of designers doing very creative stuff. And okay, it might not be as outlandish as it used to be, but I don't think at the moment it's to the detriment of the event. I think there's still enough of a balance for London to be seen as creative, as, you know, generating new ideas, but still as being quite professional as well.
There's a story in the newspaper last week from Lisa Armstrong in the Telegraph talking about New York Fashion Week, which, of course, precedes London.
Yes.
And she was sort of talking about how the week seems slightly less important than it used to. What is this tussle between all the weeks? Is it a major thing in the fashion industry?
There was a huge problem a few seasons back where New York was overlapping with London by several days, and then Milan was trying to move ahead, and there was everyone fighting for space. So there is a bit of that actually, you know, is that one more important than this one? But I think what's actually important is to work together, because we all have to go to all of them. And, you know, I think people were stranded in New York trying to get to London this season. So I think it's important that they actually all work together. And there are so many fairs now, you know, even if we take it down to a less premium level and you look at Pitti Uomo and London Collections Men, they've been bickering now for a couple of seasons over their clash of dates. So I think it's important to work together, because all these events and fashion weeks are trying to do the same thing. So I think if they can help each other out, then that's the best thing.
Alessandri, thank you very much for joining me. Now, to chew over what the week has held for many of the buyers who fly in to imbibe the best of local talent, I am joined by Justin O'Shea. He's the buying director of Mytheresa, one of the world's leading online stores for luxury fashion. Justin, welcome to the show. On the international circuit, what makes London different, do you think, now, especially from a buyer's point of view? Because I think there's, as we discussed earlier, there's always been the creativity and the design talent, but it's a commercial centre now, isn't it, too? Orders are being written here, is that correct?
I think with London, that separates it from the other cities is that there is less of the bigger established brands. So in New York, you know, you have your Michael Kors, you know, Donna Karan's, Diane von Furstenberg's, Calvin Klein's, these huge brands, which you kind of know what you're getting every season to a degree. And the same with Milan and same with Paris. But I think with London, it's a bit of a mystery. It's still unexpected because the designers coming up like Christopher Kane, Erdem, Mary Katranzou, Peter Pilotto, which are leading the charge of the new wave of designers, are still kind of finding their way. And actually, maybe their aesthetic is a mystery. So when you do get to the show, that you can feel this anticipation, and it's like, oh, what's Christopher going to do today? And no one can guess it. And that's what makes it so fun.
Yeah. And I guess from your point of view, sort of doing a circuit, you know, twice a year of 4 weeks of travel, kind of that element of surprise must be really nice to actually find something that, you know, you don't know what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's those brief moments of when you see something come down the runway and you're just smiling to yourself and you can see everyone turning around going, oh my God, you see, that's amazing. It's like, I never would have expected this. And it's like, that's so crazy. How did he come up with that? And in between, you know, like you said, day in and day out, 4 weeks of shows in a row, that 5 minutes of excitement is worth everything.
So what special moments have you had in London over the past couple of days? Who's been really ticking your box?
Mary Catranzu, who showed last night, you know, she's the last few seasons from Mary have been kind of interesting for her because she started off so strongly because of her prints. You know, she is the master of a digital print and really started off that kind of look from the London designers. But obviously it's quite difficult once you sort of do the same thing, people pigeonhole you. And I think Mary's show last night was the breakthrough collection for her. And it was really like one of the most beautiful things that I've seen all season from New York and also from London. Christopher Kane, once again today, I mean, I'm not even sure how to describe Christopher Kane's look because it's kind of just, that's just Christopher. I mean, it's almost confrontational beauty. You know, you're kind of like looking at the sun, like you shouldn't look at it, but you can't look away. I mean, he's amazing at what he does, and he's really one of the most exciting designers in the world. And also Erdem today that I saw was exceptionally beautiful. Like the attention to detail, the artisanal quality, and just the glamour and sophistication from such a young designer. I mean, it's very rare, and he does things which is far beyond his years.
And I think a few years ago when sort of some of these designers would start out showing in London, they get established and they sort of fly off to Milan and start showing there. Do you think there's no risk of that temptation now that London has suddenly become a real back on the map as a place to show?
I think for those guys that I mentioned, I think they're pretty much solidified themselves here in London. And I don't think, especially with the BFC being so influential with bringing buyers and press back to London, you know, it would be, and then with Burberry coming back, you know, and the men's collections also helping the excitement around London fashion, I don't think that they'll be going unaware unless they start becoming like the new creative directors of a Lombard or Givenchy, but that's something different. But I think their brand, they are London.
Any key trends that you've been noticing?
I mean, one thing I did see on the runway is it's very kind of like cocktail evening orientated. Like there's less that casual wear, sort of like that day-to-day pieces. And it's more special. There's a lot of embellishments, a lot of adornment. There is a lot of gowns. It's very much seems to be that they're reaching for that almost like a couture client. You know, it's a woman which is searching for something that can buy anything but wants something special. And that's also something which, you know, like I've noticed not only from this week but also from the pre-collections is that there is a strong influence towards designing for the top tier customer. You know, everyone is after that top tier luxury market. People don't want to be in the middle anymore. And the downside is, I mean, prices are going up, but also the quality of the garments is increasing as well.
What are you looking for as a buyer when you go to these shows? Obviously, as a member of the press, we're looking for sort of the headline acts. Whereas, are you looking for the more sort of commercial pieces, the things that are really going to sell? Or do your customers still look for, you know, more interesting finds? What do you keep your eye out for?
It's such a difficult thing looking from a buying point of view because sometimes when you're sitting at the show, you're looking at pieces and you're like, oh, I love that, but I probably can't buy it. You know, so it's like one thing will go past you, like, oh, I can buy that, you know, not so exciting, but I'm sure it will sell. And then the thing which your heart goes towards is sometimes the most complicated pieces, but if you don't have one, you can't sell the other. So it's always finding the balance between, you know, commerciality and, you know, exciting the customer. And then it's just getting the right mix so one can trade off the other when it comes to actually selling the product. But one thing that I have seen is that the end consumer is really looking for the special pieces, which is great for me because I buy completely uncommercial half the time anyway. So that's quite lucky.
And any new finds, any kind of young brands that you've been surprised by and peeled out from under rocks anywhere?
So far in London, no, not particularly. I think with the new generation of designers really solidifying them, I'm really concentrating on building them as brands. And so I want to sort of like provide much more like budget and attention to really grow these designers so that they can be the next Saint Laurent, the next Givenchy, the next Balenciaga. And sometimes if you spread yourself too thin, you know, like you're not really helping anyone. And especially on my Teresa, I have such a focus on growing the brands rather than always, oh, this is new, and then next season that's new, because sometimes, you know, the designers go by the wayside, and that definitely doesn't help them or help me.
Perfect. And on to Milan next. You looking forward to that?
Yeah, I am. I'm quite excited about Milan. There's always kind of like Milan the last few seasons has been a little difficult and maybe less inspiring as some of the other weeks. So
why difficult?
It's kind of not here nor there. You know, like the designers have such strong heritage, but they're obviously trying to like renew the brand. So that's obviously a very difficult transitional period for them, because a lot of the customers just want what Pucci does all the time. Mm. But the designer wants to provide a new Pucci or a new Missoni. So it's, I think they're just finding themselves at the moment. So I'm very excited to see how this season goes.
Justin O'Shea, thank you very much. That's all for our London Fashion Week coverage. But after this short break, we'll be back to meet the people behind furniture brand Vitsu.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. For more than 50 years, fans of furniture brand Vitsu have not just bought its products, shelving systems, chairs underpinned by modular and adjustable design, but they've also bought into its philosophy, as championed by German designer Dieter Rams. And now the company is calling on those fans for some help. Vitsu has big plans, physical expansion and relocation plans that Mark Adams, managing director, wants realised with £5 million of customer funding. In return for buying bonds in the brand, the customer gets a healthy return along with a front seat in the company's growth. Section D's Aled John popped down to the current home in Camden Town, central London, to meet Mark and the team in the midst of an exciting period.
Good morning, Vitsu.
Hi there.
This building we've been in for 8 years, and when we came in here we were delighted by the amount of space we had, but we have ever increasingly been constrained by the space. We're now over three times the size of when we came in here, and all of that volume has to go through the building you're about to see.
So tell me where we are, Mike. We're on the floor of the production studio, is that correct?
Yes, we're in our building in Camden where all of our product comes through from our various suppliers, virtually all of whom are in the UK, two or three outside the UK. And we do all of the final assembly work in this building. So every order is coming in worldwide 24 hours a day, which has been the real transformation in our business in the last five or so years, is the fact that we are now selling to more than 60 countries.
How did you break into those other countries?
Well, we have shops in London, New York, Los Angeles, Tokyo, Munich and Copenhagen. So those six on the ground ourselves. But in many respects, we're a dot-com in disguise. We might look like a furniture manufacturing business or indeed a furniture retail business, but so much of the effort over the last dozen, 15 years has been going into the digital infrastructure behind the scenes, so that 95% of our money is paid online. It's the way in which we interact with our customers is through our online platform. And so we passionately believe that it's the combination of physical spaces, really high quality human beings face to face, and great technology behind the scenes, so that there's no thought of, is this just an online business or is this just a physical business? This is absolutely both, and that's how we're finding the audience worldwide.
Should we take a tour?
Yep, sure. So on this side, we've got the all of the aluminium extrusion work. So they're coming in here, 5.5 meter long extrusions, which then run through, cut, all of the components are added. So you're seeing here finished extrusions with the tracks added to them, various turned parts added into the end, and then going into cardboard tubes to disappear off around the world. So that's what we do on this side.
And do you outsource the manufacture of these parts, or do you have other outposts within the UK and they all get funneled through here?
These are all of our dedicated suppliers who are making all of these components to our specification. So in this building, it's pretty well the clean assembly is what's going on, but the extruding of aluminium, die casting of aluminium, forming sheet steel and many other processes besides injection molding, that's all going on with dedicated suppliers outside the business. So it's much more akin to a very small version of a car plant these days, where there's actually very little manufacturing going on in the car plant. They are assembly operations for secondary and tertiary suppliers. So funnily enough, for example, what we'll see in looking around the building is the amount of development work we've done in the last 3 years on the chair program that we've now put back into production, Dieter Rams's original chair from 1962. And that's allowed us to tap into secondary and tertiary suppliers to Bentley, Rolls-Royce, Jaguar Land Rover, Aston Martin, all in the UK. And that's been a really important development in our business, finding those high-quality suppliers who can allow us to make world-class quality furniture.
The demand that you guys are now dealing with for your product, it's sort of forcing you to reconsider the space that you work in, as we were discussing.
Yep.
This room is bursting at the seams with equipment.
Yep.
And products about to be sent off. How big a space do you need?
Our first step from here would be to a building about three times the size of this building, which we could gobble up pretty quickly. And certainly in terms of where we're projecting to go over the next 3 to 5 years, that's what we would need as first phase. But we are intending to put that on a piece of land that would then allow us to double that again. So we could go to 5 to 6 times the size of what we're standing in over a 10 or 15 year period. And so that's why we're wanting to go the route of buying our own piece of land that would allow that to happen. You go and look at German Mittelstand businesses and you can walk around a factory and you can see you're in the first factory the parents' generation built, and you're standing in the factory that the children's generation have built, and then there are the cows on the field next door, which is where the next generation will go. And that's because they've thought this through by buying enough land to allow the growth for the business. So it's that kind of model that we're now trying to deploy.
It's that kind of confidence that Vitsu is not afraid to display. It's the same attitude that underlies the invitation to its customers to invest by buying bonds in the company at a healthy rate of return.
Come up on a forklift, be distributed around this building, then be assembled, and then go back down. So the inefficiencies in that are fairly clear. We've just announced on Saturday that we exchange contracts on Friday afternoon for a 3.3 acre piece of land in the West Midlands, which would allow us to put maybe 50, 60,000 square feet eventually on that piece of land. So that's a very important part of the process. We've run an architectural competition, which we concluded 4 weeks ago by selecting the architectural team, engineering, landscape, environmental, etc. So we've now got those two key elements in place. So now it's the finance. The Vitsu bond closes this Thursday, 13th of February, 101 years after Niels Vitsu's birth, the founder of the business. And that will be stitched together with other streams of funding as well to allow us over the next probably 2 years to develop that land and realise the building that we can move into. And that would be the first phase of the building. And that building is being designed in such a way that we could extend it relatively simply. So it won't surprise you to know that Vitsu's approach to a new building is to come up with a system that can be easily reconfigured and developed, because that's what underlies all of our products, is a system-based thinking, and we're trying to apply that to a building as well, hence why we're wanting to do it ourselves rather than just go and rent a standard building, because so many of those buildings we've looked at, they just don't measure up to what we would like to achieve from a new building.
The global demand of Vitsu products comes thanks to a devoted, if quiet, following. Mark tells me that, until now, the Vitsu brand suffered, if you can call it that, from a loyal but cagey fan base. This is now a company in the midst of transition, on the way to bigger things. Product developer Keith Henderson talks me through one of their upcoming designs, a reworking of the Vitsu Dieter Rams chair from the 1960s. Its manufacture is multi-layered and labour-intensive.
It was built to last a very long time. We've still got chairs in our archive from the 60s and 70s, which are just as comfortable to sit on.
By setting up each part to be replaceable, the design team have also pledged to create parts that match with models bought 50 years ago. It's called retrofitting.
Whilst we've re-engineered it to make it better, it still needs to fit with how it used to be. So you don't see it from the outside, the effort that we go to behind the scenes. And so
up in the office, Mark outlines how the future of the company is dependent on customer support, received through its invitation to buy bonds.
Oh, it's fundamental to the future of the business. We're trying to set up now over the next 2 years, both in terms of funding, ownership structure, governance, and therefore the building that we could occupy, which will set the business up for the next 20 years. And what's been wonderful is not only the financial support, but it has been the trouble that so many people have gone to write their expressions of support. But equally, people expressing support who run their own businesses, bigger, more successful than our business, and just wanting to chip in and give us confidence to say what you're doing is the right thing. And they know that there will be plenty of other people trying to persuade us not to do it because it might be a bit too risky and what if it all goes wrong, all of which we take on board. But there comes a point where you do have to take a certain element of risk and just get on and do it. So I think it's been, to us, hugely helpful over the last 4 weeks to see those expressions of support come through.
For Monocle, in Camden Town, I'm Alad John.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Staying in the capital now, let's head to King's Cross, where the Finnish Institute in London and the Architecture Foundation have recently launched Viewpoint, a new floating platform at Camley Street Natural Park produced for London Wildlife Trust. Hoping to connect visitors with the wildlife of the park and the Regent's Canal, the joint commission was designed by emerging Finnish architects Erko Arti, Arto Ollila and Mikki Ristula, offering Londoners a chance to get away from hectic city life on a secluded islet in the heart of the city. Monocle's Maddy Arouge sat down with Arto Ollila and Mikki Ristula, two of the Helsinki-based architects. She started by asking Arto about the thinking behind the small-scale pavilion and how it fits into the park.
The initial idea was that when we're building something to the Camley Street Park, we don't want to take anything away from the park. And since the park cannot expand anymore to the city, we decided that it's best to put in the canal along the park, so that way it's like a business card seen from afar to the park, and also the visitors can have a different kind of look to the park from the river.
The park is really a miracle in itself, because only 30 years ago, when the park was founded, it was an abandoned coal yard with really contaminated soil and absolutely nothing growing on it. And now when you walk in the park today, it really feels just like eternal and like it's been there forever. And I think that really shows the power of nature, and this was also something we wanted to reflect in our design.
And when you saw the site, how did you go about it in terms of what materials you were going to use, the structure itself?
When we first saw the site, we were really excited by the harsh contrast between built and unbuilt and man and nature in the area, and of course it's developing very fast at the moment, so that contrast is going to get even stronger. And we wanted to somehow reflect this idea of the sensitive relationship between man and nature in the design.
Yeah, I think the main material palette came from the surroundings, because they're like old steel canal barges rusting, and as the park has been an old coal yard, so we wanted to have this sort of industrial feeling on the outside of the pavilion. But then because people are using and small children are using it, we wanted to inside to be like soft wooden interior space.
So I think it's really interesting that we have this material palette of three main materials that are all constantly changing at a different pace as they get older and, you know, as weather conditions change. So I think, you know, the pavilion never looks the same from one day to another.
For example, the exterior surfaces will get a lot darker during the age, and the wood will turn a bit grey, so they change constantly, and also when it rains, the cotton is immediately darker as the concrete floor. So it's nice that during one day you can have like different combinations of different materials.
I understand that the platform and the surrounding area is not 100% finished yet. What can we expect?
There's still going to be some fine detailing to the structure itself, as well as some on-site work, and a litter boom is going to be installed to prevent litter from gathering in the small tuck in the canal. And eventually the area behind the litter boom is going to be filled with these floating vegetation rafts, so the pavilion is going to be surrounded by vegetation, I think, hopefully in the summer already.
What do you want people to feel when they see your creation?
I think our main aim in the design itself was to have sort of this stranded island in the middle of London. So I think we hope that when people arrive to the platform, they will feel a bit more relaxed from the hectic city life of London and have a small break for themselves.
And we also wanted the design to speak to children, which are one of the main user groups of the pavilion. So we've added different like playful little elements that small children can study and get excited about in the design.
Architects Arto Ollia and Mickey Ristula in conversation with Maddy Arouge. Coming up, architecture critic Oliver Wainwright will join me to run through this year's Design of the Year shortlist. But first, let's cross the Atlantic to talk urban design with renowned designer and critic Michael Beirut. Michael is a partner at the New York office of Pentagram and has worked extensively in the Big Apple. He also co-founded the Design Observer. Here, in conversation with our very own Aled John, he discusses the transition New York has undergone through the years under Michael Bloomberg's mayoralty and what concerns he has for Bill de Blasio's administration's approach to city design.
Certainly there's aspects of that tenure that could be criticized, but I think as a designer and a person who cares about the quality of the built environment in New York, it's been a remarkable legacy that he's created over his dozen years in office. A lot of it has to do with the remarkable, unprecedented quality of political appointments he made while he was in office. A lot of these posts are often given to, as have in the past been given, I suspect, as rewards to faithful lieutenants or to in exchange for political patronage and other things like that. I think Bloomberg really reached out of the normal circles and really found excellent people to lead the various areas of policy that affected particularly design of the city. In some cases, you know, these are visible kind of almost borderline glamorous things like the High Line on the west side of Manhattan, the redevelopment of what was long a abandoned, decaying, elevated railway into a beautiful public park. You know, I think that's seen as being something that actually raised local real estate prices and is definitely dismissed by some as a slightly overcrowded playground for the rich, but a beautiful design by James Corner in field operations and Diller Scafidio and Renfro that I think is nearly universally admired. But that's just a visible thing. At the same time, you have everything from Jeanette Sadikon in transportation, really becoming an advocate for bike riding in the city, re-establishing all sorts of pedestrian plazas and bike rights of way on what were formerly crowded and impassable city streets. You have Man of Burden, David Burney, advocating not just for the kind of starchitecture that is an emblem of world capitals, including New York, London, everywhere else around the world, but also excellence in design for public schools, for public buildings like firehouses and waste treatment plants and things like that. They really have been very, very conscious of that over the past decade plus.
Do you foresee then that not just those people that will be moved on, but that Bill de Blasio now in power, there's a potential for a lot of the good work that was put in place being lost?
It's early days, obviously, and who can say? And his appointments have been admired and acclaimed, actually. He's picked very, very capable people to lead a lot of these areas. You know, a few early signs that I just think are not framing the argument as I'd like to see it framed are in, say, the city planning department. We were very focused on aesthetics before, and now we're going to really be focused on practical things like low-income housing and stuff like that. no one's against low-income housing, and in fact that has been and continues to be a need that New York and so many other cities have, and it's a need that has to be addressed, and it's a need that Bill de Blasio ran on as part of his platform to be elected mayor. However, this sort of false choice between practical low-income housing, practical solutions for regular people, and quote-unquote aesthetics sort of implies that design is something that is an added-on feature that costs more, is esoteric, is appreciated only by people who have refined sensibilities, and is kind of a luxury item that a city that's trying to be for all its citizens can ill afford. Now, people that really care about design know that that's not true. And certainly in the urban realm, there's not a single thing for any citizen in any neighborhood at any budget for any purpose that couldn't be improved by having good designers doing their best work for it. And in New York, you have this concentration of really ambitious designers, from established ones who, to everyone's surprise, are more than willing and more than excited to take on these small bore challenges about just, you know, simply redesigning a small public building or something like that in an obscure neighborhood, as much as they might be about doing a big commission that's highly visible. And you have, you know, architects that are just starting their careers and every stage of their careers who are just hungry to do work and full of ideas. You've got, you know, a network of schools both here in New York with Pratt, Parsons, the Cooper Union School of Visual Arts, Fashion Institute of Technology, and then, you know, Columbia, NYU, and then up to Yale and over to Princeton in the region, all contributing incredible ideas about how urban life can be transformed through design. So the talent is definitely there.
In New York, is there an idea that social housing doesn't have to be regressive?
Absolutely. And I think, again, it was, you know, maybe a worldwide trend in the mid-20th century, these ideas of slum clearance as being the first step. You just went and you found neighborhoods that that had substandard infrastructure and were filled with low-income people. It were sort of seen as being things where if you just sort of eradicated them and replaced them with neat tall towers with planted grass in between them, you'd be doing everyone a favor. And, you know, what that ignored a little bit was, you know, was the organic character of what was being replaced, which for all its faults actually reflected the way people lived. And then, you know, as you implied, this imposition by people who may or may not actually have known better of these, you know, now you'll live this way and we've got it all sorted for you so you can improve your life by just living in these big towers. And a lot of those, of course, have been disavowed. Some of the ones that have stood the test of time are actually kind of instructive to see what made them good. In New York, we had two protagonists who sort of battled it out in the public imagination, representing kind of the top-down and the bottom-up idea about what urbanism was. Through the most of the 20th century, New York City and the region, and indeed a lot of New York State, was shaped by a single guy named Robert Moses, who at one point had multiple appointments in all sorts of public and public-private entities, where he was controlling, you know, every bridge, every tunnel, every public park, every public beach, you know, housing projects, all sorts of things, and was more or less dictating terms in terms of how it's done. He sort of held sway from the 20s and 30s all the way into the 50s, and then suddenly the tide started turning, and the you know, the woman who's credited as the standard bearer for another way to think about things is the writer Jane Jacobs, who actually said, look, you know, people, you can learn about how people want to live in cities not by, you know, looking at a blank pad and a drawing board and drawing some straight lines and sort of saying there, that's much neater, but if you actually observe how they actually live, where they like to sit, where they like to walk, you know, what makes a block safe, what makes a block feel dangerous. If you can get all that done in an observational sort of way, you can extend those principles and come up with some nice ways for people to live. Oddly enough, I think that some of the most congenial sort of housing work is being done on behalf of low and middle income residents, and peculiarly, it's the most wealthy people who find themselves, or at least their investments, kind of stockpiled in these giant and perhaps too tall, vaguely inhuman towers that are sprouting up all over here, and I think in London and other places around the world. So there's this kind of peculiar inversion in terms of who's getting value from what money in terms of quality of life, but you know, the taxes paid by the latter perhaps are will help us do some interesting things for the former.
Michael Beirut, partner at Pentagram and design critic, speaking with Ala John. After the break, I'll be joined by Oliver Wainwright to look over the shortlist for 2014's Designs of the Year.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D. Last week, London's Design Museum unveiled its shortlist for Designs of the Year. The list isn't actually that short at all, with 76 nominations in the mix. They range from a pyramid-shaped floating school in Nigeria to a chemotherapy centre for children in Osaka and a cast-iron facade of Paul Smith's flagship in London's Mayfair. The 76 nominations are grouped into categories including architecture, digital, fashion, product, furniture, graphics and transport. Details of each of them will be exhibited at the Design Museum in an exhibition opening on the 26th of March. To chew over the list, I'm joined by The Guardian's architecture critic, Oliver Wainwright. Oliver, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start off. I mean, there's 76 of them. How do you think they go about sort of grouping anything that's been designed over the past 12 months into a list like this?
Absolutely no idea. And it's a terrifying prospect, you know, as a journalist to receive the 76 nominations at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, being told that it's embargoed until Monday morning and desperately trying to think of a way to analyse such a kind of broad selection of things. I think it used to be a lot easier when design was kind of fancy chairs and tables and the occasional bit of signage used to be in there. Now it's a whole kind of plethora of things, and actually the digital category this year I think is one of the most exciting of the bunch and kind of the strongest yet. So we've got everything from kind of iPhone apps to crowdsourced search and rescue mechanisms, and the furniture is still in there, but it's kind of pales in comparison to some of the digital technology that we're seeing this year.
What are some of your favourites from whichever category?
I think my favourites this year are things, I mean, there's some strong kind of entries from the medical and healthcare world, something called the ABC syringe.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, which is designed to kind of change colour once it's open to prevent people from reusing syringes in developing countries. And it also has a special kind of barrel that snaps if you try and remove the plunger, so it's impossible to reuse it. There's also an iPhone app that's also designed for use in developing countries that turns your phone into a kind of pocket optician for eye care tests in places that can't receive the kind of standards of healthcare that we're used to and yet still have iPhones. You know, that's the kind of amazing ubiquity of smartphones these days. Something that I wouldn't be able to live without myself is City Mapper, which has been nominated for the digital category again, which kind of amalgamates all of the data that TfL and other transport companies around the world produce and has a simple button called Get Me Home. So no matter how drunk you are at the end of the night, you still know how to get home.
Designs for life.
Exactly.
And back to more of your turf, architecture. Any particular standouts on the list?
Well, I was really pleased and surprised actually to see the 6A project on there for Paul Smith's facade. And to me, it shows what power a simple shop window can have. And again, that's the kind of thing that would have been ignored in the past. And it's a very subtle project, a series of cast iron panels put onto a Georgian building in Mayfair, but incredibly well detailed down to the touch, where they've even done a kind of artificially worn front step in the threshold that just gives the building a sense of kind of tactility that a lot of modern shops lack. I mean, you've got the obvious names on the list, David Chipperfield and Zaha Hadid, both doing enormous cultural centres for slightly dubious clients in Mexico City and Azerbaijan. I think the architecture section is maybe slightly less interesting than some of the others because it's a whole world unto itself, which has so many of its own awards.
Do you think they sort of pulled out more of the big blockbuster projects here, which the other architecture prizes would probably go into more sort of niche, unknown projects?
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, that they like to get the big names, you know, for media coverage, and also because it's what the public know, perhaps. I was really pleased to see Lacaton et Vassal on the list again for the second year running for their amazing kind of ghost project in Dunkirk in northern France, where they were given an old shipping warehouse to turn into an art gallery, and they walked into the space, which has similar proportions to the Tate Turbine Hall, and they said, actually, this is an amazing space. We can't turn this into a gallery. gallery. So they left it exactly as it was and built a kind of doppelganger right next to it in steel and glass and aluminium, an incredibly kind of delicate building that looks like a ghostly apparition on the horizon. So I'm very pleased to see that on the list.
Now, in among all these sort of the big name projects, there are a few sort of smaller lo-fi architectural projects. This floating school in Nigeria is particularly interesting, and I think actually been really media friendly for the prize.
Yeah, well, it's by a guy called Kunle Adeyemi, I think, if I got the pronunciation right, who was a former partner of OMA and a very interesting guy. He was behind a lot of their big projects in Qatar that are now under construction. And this is the first project that he's kind of done out on his own. And yeah, it's a kind of prototype for a floating school, which shows how a whole series of floating structures could be built on this lagoon in Nigeria. So yeah, really interesting prototype, and look forward to seeing what else comes out of it.
Any winner that you can spot?
I'd be really pleased to see it go to one of these kind of smaller scale projects, maybe something that began on Kickstarter, like the Phone Blocks project, which was rethinking how mobile phones are made. I mean, we throw away thousands, probably millions of mobile phones every year just because like the camera breaks or the Wi-Fi antenna breaks. So Dave Hackens reinvented the very way we kind of think of a phone going together and separated all the components. So Phone Blocks is an idea. You can build your own mobile phone and you have a separate Wi-Fi block, separate battery, a separate display, and they kind of click together like a Lego kit, which means that when the camera breaks, you just throw away that little part and the whole thing doesn't have to go into landfill. So it's a kind of fundamental rethinking of quite a simple everyday object, and I think that's the kind of thing that deserves to win.
Yeah. We see a lot of these sort of prizes being given out. What do you think the value of a competitive project like this is when it's so all-encompassing and so global? Is there rather than just sort of getting headlines and using up an exhibition space for the summer, is there any actual value in it, do you think?
I think there is, actually. And if you look at the project that won last year, there was a great outcry because it went to the redesign of the central government website, gov.uk, you know, at a time when all of our services are being slashed. People saw it as kind of putting a sticking plaster over the fact that, you know, all services were being completely cut. Let's have a nice, fancy new website. Actually, that completely ignored the kind of potentially revolutionary effects that it's had, because it's completely stripped away all of the rubbish that you get on those kind of public sector websites. It's made an incredibly simple kind of logical path through the site. You know, it's not a design in the conventional sense of like choosing a nice font, although they have actually chosen quite a nice font. It's designed by Margaret Calvert. But it's more about how you kind of navigate your way through this, what would otherwise be an incredible kind of mess of bureaucracy to access public services. So I think in celebrating things like that that are too often ignored and overlooked, it has a really valuable role. And there's a similar project on the list this year, actually, from, I think it's the Melbourne Public Transport Authority that developed an app and an animation called Dumb Ways to Die, which has an incredibly catchy theme tune.
Set fire to your hair, poke a stick at a grizzly bear, eat medicine that's out of date, use your private parts as piranha bait. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die.
You have these little characters and you have to stop them from dying, stop them from kind of electrocuting themselves and having their heads sliced off, so yeah, that's popular appeal.
Sounds like a potential winner. And do you think, you know, the fact that this is sort of shortlisted by the Design Museum, do you envisage it going to one of the more traditional design sectors again this year?
I have faith in the Design Museum as kind of waving the flag for more relevant design. And I think that, you know, the thing that won last year shows that is on the agenda. I think it'll probably go to something kind of disruptive or something that points towards the way that design is going. So I think it probably won't go to this because it's probably deemed as too corporate, but something like Nest Lab's smoke detector and carbon monoxide alarm, which is an example of this kind of much heralded Internet of Things. you know, an object in our own homes that's connected to the internet and will send us a text message when the battery is running low. And it's designed with a kind of human feel. You know, you can wave at it to stop it from beeping. And it's just adding a kind of extra dimension to an everyday household object. And also, as you know, it's been recently acquired by Google, the whole of Nest Lab. So it kind of represents a deeper infiltration of Google into every aspect of our lives, which might not be something to celebrate.
Well, we'll have to wait and see who the winner is. Oliver, thank you very much for joining me with Section D. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer, Aled, at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, after 5 hectic days of London Fashion Week, for all those people who haven't slept much, this is London Grammar with Night Call. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. I'm giving you a night call to tell you.